Good morning and welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show. I'm Amy Otto, joined by Lee Cantor. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Amy. A little subdued today.
A little subdued? No.
You're all flu misted up?
I am. I got my flu mist this morning. I'm feeling flu free.
So you believe in the swine flu?
You know, the last two guests that we've had that have talked about the swine flu, they did. They scared me enough to where I thought, oh, what can it hurt, right? So I went and got the vaccine.
What could it hurt? Famous last words.
I feel great, though. Although, remember, the Dr. George was kind of against the vaccine.
I know. Swine 2K.
Swine 2K was we need to market that.
I know.
Yeah.
Trying to have it catch on.
I think it probably will. Although, I will go through the entire winter without flu.
Good. Right?
So
just because of that mist.
Just because of the mist. And it didn't hurt at all, and I feel great. I'm also excited about our show this morning, and I feel great about our show for a lot of reasons. You know, everybody's talking about the doom and gloom and the economy, and it's kind of depressing, but we have a positive light to shed today. I'm very privileged this morning to have with us Brad Wolf, who had a great article in Atlanta Business Chronicle this past week. If you haven't seen it, it's on page 40, and Brad's here to talk about how we can keep our morale high in a down economy. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show, Brad.
Thank you. Appreciate it having me.
So, you know, it is sort of a recessionary period, and a lot of people are losing jobs. People are eliminating the raises. Tell us, what really inspired you to write the article?
Well, just pretty much what you're saying there, talking to candidates that are looking for jobs, talking to owners of businesses and managers who are hiring and hearing their concerns really got me thinking about providing some information that can be acted upon without them spending more money. And so that's what breeded this.
How did you learn about how to increase morale? I mean, have you managed people before? What's your background?
Well, actually, it's really a combination. Managing employees over the years, also being a recruiter for over 17 years, and recruiting candidates and listening to what they have to say in terms of why they're not interested in leaving their companies and also why they really are interested in leaving their companies. In addition to this, did a pretty fair amount of research on the matter and really combined personal experience of others and the research to come up with something that's very simple and straightforward to act upon.
So what are some of the simple things people can do?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, I think one of the most important things really is communication. Keeping morale high really comes down to basic human relations, and communication is key. What people have found is that it's best to err on the side of communicating more rather than communicating less. I think the natural tendency of people under difficult times is to kind of keep quiet and not rock the boat and not say too much. Unfortunately, this usually has the opposite effect, and people know when things aren't going well anyway, so to very openly and honestly address what people know and specifically what you're doing about it breeds trust and cooperation and a feeling that everyone's in it together.
Now, how do you find, like, you know, when the economy's going bad and companies are doing poorly, the upper management doesn't want to share because they don't want to make everybody nervous, right?
Correct.
So by not sharing, you're saying that they're making people nervous anyway because people aren't idiots. They know that, hey, we haven't had a client in a few months and, you know, we're losing clients. So then they start freaking out.
That's correct. I think basic human psychology, and I think if we look at ourselves, this holds true, is when we know there's uncertainty and a negative cloud, our minds will tend to go to the darkest places. We'll tend to think the worst. So when a company approaches their employees and honestly addressing what is happening and what they're doing about it, it usually makes things a lot better because people's imaginations usually are quite a bit worse than
reality. Right.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting that you say that. So what are some of the low-cost ways that a company can improve their morale? I mean, we talked about telecommuting and things when you and I spoke. What are some of the incentives they can give to the employees that don't really cost their pocketbook?
Okay. That's a great question because employees still expect certain rewards and benefits. They expect medical insurance. They expect retirement. Whatever it is that a company's providing usually continues to be expected. So to just say we're cutting this off unilaterally without a communication with the employees usually goes over very poorly. One of the benefits of a time like this is it gives companies a way to really completely reevaluate what they're currently doing. And the reality is when people look at it is the benefits that they offer are usually just benefits they've continued to offer over the years. What happens, though, is the demographics, the priorities of the employees changes over the years, and a lot of times they're not aligned well as a result. So, for example, a company may be that the average age of the company has risen, and benefits related to child care and things related to family may not be with children may not be as important to that company as it would be to a company where they have younger employees, yet the benefits may still be focused on what people earlier in their career are consider a priority. So this gives a real opportunity to poll the employees, do a basic, simple, anonymous questionnaire to find out what's really key to them, and then from that, design a whole benefit plan based on what's most valued without spending more money and often spending less.
Sure. And I know with the holidays coming up, a lot of folks are eliminating the holiday Christmas or the holiday parties and things like that. What's your suggestion there? I liked the article and what it said. Let our listeners know what some of your creative strategies were to not eliminating the holiday festivities, but how to scale back.
Amy, that's a great point. The reality is that there's customs that companies have that they've had for years, traditions that are valued by the employees, and to simply say we're not doing this anymore really sends a chill into the organization, and it sends a message that things are not well and that we're really not teaming up together. So, for example, during good times, you know, we all hear stories or have experienced stories where there's elaborate Christmas parties, holiday parties, you know, at the Ritz, and, you know, tremendous amount of money's being spent. And understandably, it would probably go over poorly to do that under a time like this where there's cutbacks and things like that. But to eliminate the Christmas party would have a very negative repercussion in most cases. So an example that I'm seeing is either a very scaled back, very simple, low-cost Christmas party, maybe at the CEO or some other person's house having a potluck type of event where they get together and it's more of a close personal type of a thing where people participate. You know, it's really anything and everything that people feel good about, and it's sending a message that everyone's important and we still want to honor this tradition.
Great advice. Great words of wisdom. Again, I encourage our listeners to check out the Atlanta Business Chronicle this week on page 40. Check out Brad's article and read a little bit more about how you can keep the morale high in this down economy. Thanks, Brad, for being with us. And also, let our listeners know what your business is, and you've got some exciting things going on there.
Exactly. Thank you, Amy. Our business is a company called Jumpvine. Basically, we offer a better option than using traditional recruiting firms for hiring. We're typically able to help companies hire the top talent at 40% or more savings from traditional recruiting firms and 60 to 70% fewer interviews per hire. In addition, we have recently formed a strategic partnership with a human resources outsourcing and consulting firm. We feel very strongly that the issues related to how to best manage and keep the morale high with companies while at the same time lowering your cost in the process is something that's a very important message going forward, and that's why we formed this strategic partnership, because we feel that this way we have a lot more to offer to our clients.
And how can people reach you to learn more about your services and your company?
I can be reached by telephone at 678-229-2413. Can also be reached via email at bwolff@jumpvine.net.
Perfect. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks again, Amy.
You know, Lee, we've had a lot of different types of financial folks on over the years, and we haven't had anyone recently because it just doesn't seem like a fun thing to talk about.
Right.
But I'm excited about our next guest because she definitely has a positive outlook and definitely a realistic outlook. I think that when the economy's bad, it's a good time for some people to reevaluate. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show, Meredith Moore.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks for having me.
So Meredith, tell us a little bit about, you know, with the economic crisis, what are some of the things people really need to look at? If, you know, let's start if someone is older and facing retirement. Let's work our way back. So if someone's older, give us some advice.
Well, Amy, in the world of retirees, things are vastly different than those of us that are still in our earning years. When you start to get to the time when you're starting to take distributions and take money out, you can't make mistakes anymore. It's that simple. And coming off of the market that we came off of in 2008, a lot of people are going to have to revamp their whole retirement outlook. They might have to consider working a little bit longer. I mean, this is a realistic thing that's out there. That being said, 2009 has been an absolutely phenomenal year in the market. But intuitively, we all know that coming off very bad markets, you're always going to get a very good market. And that's what's happened in 2009. But it simply hasn't been enough to make up and offset these losses. So for these retirees, it's all about sequence of returns.
Okay.
And what that means is, I guess with all the marketing that's out there with investment companies, we're ingrained to what's the average return? What has the market yielded us over the history? And it's not about that anymore in retirement. If you have a 50% loss, like what many people had in 2008, it takes 100% gain to make up, to break even.
Okay.
And so it's that simple. So when you get to retirement, you can't make mistakes, again, to go back to my original point. So it's all about, hey, how does your portfolio look? What is the long-term objective? What's my time horizon? Is it realistic that I need to go ahead and try to get a part-time gig with the company that I retired from? Mm-hmm. Do I need to go do some contract work if, say, you're in the IT field? You know, where is the money going to come from? What are your income needs? And how are you projected? How are your assets projected to pay down? Many people that I see, they know what they have, but they haven't realistically put together their cash flow and said, okay, I'm spending $4,000 a month. I brought $200,000 to retirement. How does that spend down, basically? When am I going to run out of money?
Wow, that would be daunting.
Well, it's very daunting.
Think about it.
Well, and frankly, it's very real because a lot of people have not done this.
Yeah, you need to.
We live in this world of accumulation, and we know what we have, but we don't know what it translates to when we're going to run out of money. And with the influx of baby boomers hitting, people simply are not bringing enough money to retirement. They're just not. And what's going to happen is with all these people getting older, you're going to have a medical crisis, obviously, with a lot of people needing nursing and skilled care. You're going to have people that didn't bring enough money for their basic living expenses, people that are living beyond their means. You're going to have these baby boomers that are starting to take care of their parents in their own house, and they have their own kids.
Now, what's a misconception? Like, are these people just, like, in the dark? I mean, like you're talking about, mostly your clients are smart people. They're not unaware of what's going on. So are they just oblivious that?
No, I think a lot of people don't want to deal with it. We all want to deal with today.
They don't want to deal with it. What does that mean in terms, like, are they just stop working at some point and then they open up and see how much money they have?
No, they get caught up with what are my returns this year?
So they're focused on today, the moment.
Right. They're focused on today. And unfortunately, a lot of the business model in my industry is all about returns right now. But nobody's actually doing reports to project, hey, what are you living on right now? And how does that spend down? You're telling me, Amy, you want to retire at 65. You're also telling me you and your husband did a budget. You're living on $4,000 to $5,000 a month. I'm telling you, if we spend that down at age 60, you're going to run out of money at 71. What are you going to do?
Wow.
And people have not gotten this real-life glimpse of what's going on. And unfortunately, that's part of what I do, is to give people this reality. Mm-hmm. And like, it could be a tough thing, but a lot of people just are not bringing enough money. And again, this market has certainly not helped that. So it's kind of about time to revamp and start looking at how can we not make mistakes? How can we ensure that enough money is there? And then what do we need to do in terms of revamping the plan? Do we need to work longer or whatnot?
Revamping the plan, but maybe even redistributing how the assets are allotted. I mean,
that's part of it. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. That's part of it. In the world of investing, everything in my world is about time horizon. Okay. If somebody's saving money to buy, say, a rental property, and you know that you need that cash in 1 year, you're not going to go after an aggressive stock, let's say. You're going to put that money in a money market. In the world of retirement, you have to very specifically look at what is the time horizon in which we're going to need to start drawing an income. And that dictates how the money should be allocated, how much needs to be conservative, how much needs to be aggressive. The other big thing is inflation. And the other issue is longevity. People are living so much longer, which is why, short of speaking about statistics, but that's going to be the real issue again, is people are going to be running out of money. And we get conservative, everybody gets scared in a market like what we came off of. But if inflation is beating you and you live to age 100, which is becoming a more and more common thing, what are you going to do? And we all hope to God that Social Security is there for people like our parents and grandparents, and that's certainly not a guarantee, especially if you read the back of your Social Security statement.
Yeah, you're right about that. But on a positive note, though, I mean, you can overcome the fear by just being properly educated. Like, I'm learning from listening to you today. I mean, so you sit down with clients and you maybe take away the fear of the future by showing them how they can invest and plan now?
Right. What I try to do is we look at where are their investments right now. A lot of people know what they have, but they don't really understand how they're allocated, number one. And number two, they're not really aware of how good or lack thereof that their actual investments that they hold are. I use a lot of third-party software, Morningstar, Ibbotson, things like that, that actually ranks stock, bonds, mutual funds. And my job is to get every client the valedictorian, if you will, in each of the asset classes. And asset classes are, we all talk about diversification, maintaining the proper diversification. But let me say this, diversification is not owning three mutual funds that might have three different fund companies. Owning Fidelity, owning American Funds, you know, that's why I'm all about software, owning large companies, owning medium-sized companies, owning small companies, international, both developed and emerging markets. How many different types of bonds do you have? A lot of people don't know this. Commodities in 2008 was the only positive producing asset class through September. Every stock index, large, medium, small, everything was down except for commodities. That was because of oil. And then, of course, oil went down in September. Our gas prices went up. So that's what we saw at the pump. So it's about owning many asset classes. It's about owning the valedictorian in each of those asset classes. And it's about a systematic way of monitoring that with your advisor.
Now, do you find that this crisis has made people more open to listening to your tough love?
Tough love. I like the way you call it, tough love.
I don't market myself as tough love. I think people are more open to second opinions, but the nature of my business is so trust-based that if I'm not introduced to somebody personally or if it's not a referral, people aren't as open to a second opinion until they really understand how I'm set up.
Now, do you find a lot of people, like maybe they worked in a big corporation and they have accumulated something in a 401k and then they get laid off and now they're deciding, now they have this pile of money and they're deciding, what should I do now? Should I do my own thing? Should I, you know, wait for that next consulting job or get another job somewhere else? Like, how do you help them in that regard?
When somebody first gets laid off from a big corporate position, and we're seeing a lot more of that, everybody's actively out there that I'm working with is actively looking for a job. In terms of addressing their financial issues and their financial planning, what I find is when anybody has some sort of major life event, regardless of what it is, they're frozen. Consequently, even doing something like what you alluded to, Lee, say you leave Coca-Cola and you have a big 401k, and again, without going through the tax ramifications, but rolling that out to an IRA is a no-brainer, doesn't cost the client anything, it provides them a lot of estate planning benefits. Somebody that just got laid off is likely not going to do that just because they don't want to make any changes. Mm-hmm. And I saw that a lot in the first quarter of this year. Mm-hmm. Things that didn't affect somebody one iota in the way of cash flow, they weren't even doing that. Not to mention, say, any insurance products that affected their bottom line.
Right.
But really, after we got past that second quarter, I was finding the market loosened up a little bit, and people were more willing to get that second opinion, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, our listeners right now that are hearing Meredith, she's obviously very passionate about what she does. Meredith, you have all kinds of awards. You were listed as the top 40 under 40. By the Atlanta Business Chronicle, and you were profiled in Newsweek magazine. You were actually on NBC because of your participation in the Aflac Iron Girl Triathlon. I mean, a lot of success and a lot of knowledge and a lot to share with folks. How can they reach you? I mean, if someone's listening and they think, wow, this is an eye-opening, you know, wake-up call or a little tough love, as Lee says, and you know, they know that the economy isn't great now, but they know that they need to plan forward. How can they reach you?
Absolutely. I can be reached via my office at 770-587-0281. Also have a website, www.moremorewealth.com.
I also see you taught finance to 12th graders. How was that?
That was pretty cool. My problem was living in a world of overachievement in high school and college. They should have put me in an AP class. I think they decided that I needed to not be teaching the on-level kids, but I had a lot of fun, and I was trying to teach modern portfolio theory to a bunch of 16 and 17-year-olds, so that was kind of fun, but I had a good time.
Bet. Great.
I bet they need it. I bet there's nowhere near enough just basic education and finance for kids.
There isn't, and I probably needed to take it down a notch, but I do that once in a while.
That's great. Thanks for sharing with us today, Meredith.
Thanks, Amy.
Wow, Lee. I mean, one of my least favorite subjects to talk about, finance, she made it very exciting.
Yes, she did.
I'm still wide awake over here. Definitely. And there is so much to learn, and like she says, you really have to plan for the future. Planning for the future, and definitely someone that's not afraid, not talking doom and gloom, is our next guest, Damon. And Damon, I'm just dying to hear more about the Jet Sox. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show. We have Damon Borosny.
Thank you for having me.
So, Damon, you know, people are talking times are tough, but your mind is still working. Tell us about Jet Sox.
What Jet Sox is a way for regional airlines to get more flights out on time. Because really what happens is a plane sits on a tarmac at night. It gets this light layer of frost on it. And this light layer of frost doesn't affect the flyability of the plane, really. But based on FAA regulations, has to be de-iced. It's based on the pilot's judgment. So what happens is the pilot goes out there. He says, yes, I need to de-ice. Well, your plane is immediately late. We've all sat there on the tarmac while the plane is de-iced. Well, you're automatically late because that's not built into the flight schedule. So what we've done is we've developed a system of wing covers that cover the flying surfaces of the airplane. So that's the wing and the tail. It's put on at night after the last flight of the day by a two-man ground crew attached on. In the morning before the first flight's out, take the wing covers off, throw them off to the side, and boom, your flight goes out on time.
Or typically, the first flight, is that the one that needs to be de-iced? Like, once the plane's going back and forth, you don't have to de-ice it in between?
It does depend. In the early morning, what you have is frost. That's the stuff that's on your car in the mornings when you come out on your windshield. That's typically what's on there in the mornings. During the day, sometimes during flight, you'll get some ice, and then while you're sitting between legs, the plane will accumulate ice. That's not what our product does.
Right. Yours is for to do overnight and for the early morning.
Exactly. Right? Ours is a preventative measure. De-icing typically is reactive, which is why you're late. They don't build that into the schedules. If you put the covers on at night, you're preventing the frost accumulation on your flying surfaces. So you're actually being proactive as opposed to being reactive.
How in the world do you come up with this? Are you sitting there waiting for a flight and anxious because you're not getting off the ground? I mean, what made you?
I bet you were at your own car, right? It was your car, and you're like, why couldn't there be something? I just cover my carport. There's no ice.
You know, it is an awesome idea, and I wish I could take credit for it, but I can't. My partner, his name's Cliff Atkins. He is a pilot, and he had to deal with this. He's a commercial pilot. And, you know, he walks out to his plane. He's the one who had to make the judgment call of, do we fly or do we de-ice? Well, you know, he wants to take off on time. He wants to, you know, fly and move. And, you know, he was just getting irritated with this thin layer of frost that really didn't affect anything, but he knew that he had to for the safety of the aircraft. So he just said, there's got to be a better way. And it just struck him. And, you know, it sat in his mind for a long time. And then when we met, we just started talking about it. And years later, it just sort of came up, and we just started moving on it one day. Something, I don't know exactly what shifted, but one day we just said, okay, we're going to do this.
So is it recent?
2 years.
2 years, okay.
Yeah, it's been about, yeah, it's a year and a 2 years.
So now, with planes being all different shapes and sizes, how do you make it to, is it something that's customized to each plane?
Yes, it is. Really, what we're talking about is regional jets. These are your 50, 70, 90-seater jets. You know, you might go from Atlanta to Chicago or from Atlanta to Charlotte. You know, we're not talking like your DC-9s, your 737s. So there's, what we did is we looked at the market and to see how many different aircraft are in there. And then basically we just did triage. You know, 60-70% of the regional airline market is covered by four aircraft type. So we're starting with those four, getting covers made, custom covers made for those, and then moving on to go down the list as those become more popular.
So how has it been? I mean, this almost sounds like a recession-proof business. People are still flying. People want to get out on time. I mean, what's it been like? Has it been scary? Has it? I mean, tell us a little bit more about your journey in starting a company.
For us, it's a no-brainer. You know, we are in love with our product, and we have to, and I have to fight that every day. That I know that this thing works. I know it's a great idea. It's my job to prove that value to my potential customers. And it's tough. De-icing works, flat out. Spraying hot liquid on a cold aircraft does its job, and it does it well. And so getting people to see that there's something else possible is the challenge.
And I saw from your website, too, there it's green. What does that mean? I mean, everybody's talking about their companies are going green.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Basically, the aircraft de-icing fluid is toxic. It is harmful to the environment. And what it does is it literally robs the oxygen out of the water that it touches.
So it's not just water?
No. This is hot. It's propylene glycol or ethylene glycol. And what that is basically de-icing. It's antifreeze.
Uh-huh.
Spray it on the plane. You mix it with water based on how cold and humid is the mixture that you get. But essentially, it's still poison that you're spraying all over the plane. But it works.
Right.
You know, the stuff works really good. The reason that our product is green is that it enables them to spray less.
Got
it. You know, so the stuff is sold, you know, it's sold by the gallon, just like gas. It has oil in it. So it fluctuates. And so what we enable them to do is to spray less so they could save money, and it helps their environmental initiatives, which airlines are really under the gun with. So that's one reason that we have a green product.
Can you talk a little bit about, you had this idea and, you know, you were figuring out how to do it, and then you built your first one. What was it like when you sold that first one? Can you talk us through that?
I hope to be able to tell you that really soon. Because we haven't sold one yet.
You haven't sold one yet?
No.
So you're still at the stage where you have it and you're still pitching it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even that's exciting. You know, there's small wins in there. You know, when we first saw them on the wing.
Right.
That's just an amazing idea. Because, these, you know, these things, they're, you know, one wingspan is 60 feet. So, you know, you got 30 foot of cover on each side.
Right.
That's really exciting. You know,
what's it like when you're putting it there at the airport on some planes, right? Mm-hmm. You have to test it and stuff. Mm-hmm. When other pilots say, "Hey, what is that thing?"
Yeah, man. If you tell people, yeah, it's we work for JetSox. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, what's JetSox?
Right.
You know, and they all get it. They immediately it's such an easy thing for people to understand. Put the cover on. Frost forms on the cover.
Take it off. On the wing. No frost on the wing. Get
exactly.
It and leave.
Exactly. It's right. Well, you know what we found is that we went to a trade show, the industry trade show called the Regional Airline Association, and we're displaying, we have a booth there. And after the first day, Cliff and I were sitting around talking about how it went, and what I realized is that people expect it to be much more complicated.
Right.
In fact, one of the conversations we had for how to pitch it the next day was, how can we make it more complicated?
Oh, gosh.
You know, and then, you know, we decided against it, but that was just one of the things. They were waiting for the and.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, you mm-hmm. put them on, you take them off, and?
Then what happens?
Right. Right. And no, you take them off.
That's it. It's the end.
Yeah, exactly. There's nothing more. Yeah, that's my sales
pitch. How much time does it save a person? Like, how long does it take to de-ice a plane as opposed to, you know, taking this on and off?
Yeah. So de-icing a plane, you know, you have a lot of places now, you can't de-ice at the gate anymore. You have to fly, you have to taxi out to a de-ice pad, turn off the engines, de-ice, fire the engines back up, then get back in line and take off. So that,
so with,
you know,
the
that,
people
that,
are
that,
on the plane?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, this is always when people are on the plane. So you might push back. Your flight's at 8:10. You might push back on time. Technically, that flight's on time.
Wow.
Because the
FAA, they go by when it pushes back.
When
right.
it pushes off the gate. But you're still 20 minutes out. And if it's a rough day, I mean, you got 9 aircraft ahead of you.
Right.
You know, so it could add 20 minutes to your schedule. Mm-hmm. So your plane is late arriving, but it's okay taking off.
Right.
You know, but where our covers can be put on by a 2-man ground crew in 20 minutes and taken off even faster.
And there's typically 2-man ground crews mm-hmm. available for most.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, what we provide is we provide the training as well as the covers. So we'll go to their locations. We'll train their people how to use them. Not like there's much, you know, there's really not much to it. You
right.
roll them on, clip, 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 and, right. you know, you're done.
No, it's a great product.
It's a great product. So we need to have Damon on another, maybe a year from now, so we can yeah. hear how exciting and how it's taken off.
I'll gladly tell you how it is to sell my 100th cover.
Hopefully. Yes. Yeah,
that'd be awesome.
How awesome would that be? Well, I really admire your courage to start something new. And I'm sure
it's the best investment, Meredith would say, to invest in yourself, right?
I imagine.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Invest in yourself and invest in your passion. You're obviously very passionate about it. Thank you so much for being with us today, Damon.
Thank you.
Jet Sox, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, no, it's great.
We have Jet Sox, and we've had as a guest early on the airport booty guy.
I thought it was the same thing. I thought he changed the name.
No, Alan Hess was a guest, and he has these little slippers that you wear when you go through security, airline booties. And, you know, Alan came on when his product was right. in its infancy.
I was just talking to him recently, you know.
Yeah, I just talked to him last night, as a matter of fact. His dog's sick.
Did you tell him about the Jet Sox?
I told him about the Jet Sox, and he laughed about it. He hadn't heard of it. But, you know, when he was on with the airline booties, it was just in its infancy. Now they're in Maury luggage. They're in a bunch of spots.
Right.
So it really took off. Really took off. You know, Lee, all the social media and all the stuff you see on the computer now, you almost can't have a website without a picture of yourself. And our next guest is here to talk to us about his photography business. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show, Bill Adler, who I think has an interesting perspective on his photography business. Welcome.
Well, good morning, Amy. Good morning, Lee. I'm excited to be here today. You know, a lot of people don't give a lot of thought to photography until they are, you know, forced into having a picture taken, and that is such a bad way to look at the whole process. You know, with the economy in general not doing as well as it has in the past, this is really a great opportunity for visual arts because mm-hmm. Everything now is based on the computer, and it doesn't matter if you have your website or your blog or you're on LinkedIn, you have to have some type of imagery. And, you know, your perception is everything. How people look at you, they gauge whether you're successful. If your pictures look professional, there's a feeling that your business is professional. And quite the opposite is true as well. If you could have a great business and if your pictures look amateurish, sometimes that can lead someone to think that you might not be as professional in all different areas of your business as you could be.
And something tells me you know a little bit about photography if you've actually done photography for U.S. presidents, world leaders, popular entertainers, which I got to ask you about that. Clients like IBM, UPS, Saab, Kaiser Permanente, Coca-Cola. I mean, all these big companies, most people think of photography, I think of pictures of my kids or, you know, fun pictures. But there's a real need for corporate photography. How'd you get into it? Tell us a little bit about your background and your passion.
Well, basically, I became a photographer because I couldn't paint. And there's just a lot of truth in that. Just couldn't control the brush. And I knew there was an inner artist in me, and I just had to find the medium. When I was about 14, there was a boy at school who had just gotten a new camera, and I took a look through that, and I said, this is for me. So I just went from there. I love photography. I love taking pictures, and I love to one thing I love about photography, just the commercial aspect of it aside, is that I like to retain the past. There's nothing that thrills me more than looking at old family pictures that, you know, really convey a sense of what it was like at that Thanksgiving, at mm-hmm. that holiday, at that birthday party. Because that's, you know, a lot. I don't do any wedding pictures, but a wedding photographer would be the first to tell you, you know, you spend all this money on the wedding. When it's over, the only thing left is the pictures. Mm-hmm. And so it is a way to reconnect and to pass that visual imagery on to another generation.
And even just pictures of products, too. Like if you look through a magazine, a picture, I love to cook. I'm a big culinary person. So if you look at the picture of a cake, if it's a good photo of the same cake, it just makes a big difference, whether it's, food or healthy
right.
with the sleep.
Do you do pictures of food and things like that? Because that's a different animal, isn't it?
It's a totally different animal. Yeah. And, I would be remiss if I told you I've never done it. I don't enjoy it. I enjoy eating food, not photographing it. My business is limited almost exclusively to people because I enjoy the dynamic, I enjoy the dialogue, I enjoy the interaction. I get a charge from it.
Now, what's a tip for somebody that to take a good picture, of their family or something like that? What's a mistake you see that amateurs make?
Well, there are a couple of glaring obstacles and challenges that people have all the time. It makes me just want to climb the walls. Whoever invented the digital camera with the display on the back where you don't look through the viewfinder but you look at the back of the camera, that is just like putting a wall between you and your subject, and that is just insane. You should look through the camera viewfinder, and when you see something you want to retain, snap the picture. Mm-hmm. Why create an obstacle between people? It's just like in a sales process. It's much better to sit beside someone than across the table. That's an automatic, adversarial, principal-student kind of relationship. And, when I photograph someone, to me, the camera is just a vehicle to an end. I really feel that I'm taking the pictures and the camera is incidental to the process. I raise the camera, pop, and we're back on to the next expression or emotion or scene.
When you're doing like a corporate, an executive or something like that, or a celebrity, how do you do you get to know them first, then try to capture a mood or kind of capture their personality in the background or in the photograph?
Well, that's a great question, and I would answer it in this way. It depends on the type of time that you have allowed. If you're photographing a really high-profile executive, and if you don't know who that is or what their resume is, I mean, it only benefits you to study up on them and to watch their YouTube interviews and to look at their resume because it gives you what we call camera room conversation so that you have a dialogue to discuss things with them. And that way, if they feel that you can discuss things on an equal footing, they're much more relaxed and they look at you as an equal and as a fellow professional.
Mm-hmm.
When you're photographing entertainers, they do that for a living. So many times they can just hit the set and they're off and running. So it really facilitates the task that you have at hand.
Now, if you're going to get your picture taken by somebody, is there any tips you would have for the victim? I mean, the person getting their picture taken?
Well, I would say that, the first thing you want to do is you want to get a good night's rest because if you're tired, you're going to look tired in the picture. Mm-hmm. It's just that simple. I advise men especially to have their picture taken first thing in the morning because every man has a 5 o'clock shadow. And unless someone is really adept at retouching that out, you're going to look like Fred Flintstone. Your picture just is not going to look professional. Another couple things I would mention to you is that, none of us are movie stars or few of us are. And, what you look like is what you look like. You need to have an inner peace with that and just accept that.
So you can't make it better?
Well, you can, you can enhance any picture, but does that really look like you?
There's nothing worse, actually, and I'm not picking on some of our guests, but every once in a while we'll get a picture, and then they come in, and we're like, is that the same person?
Right.
You definitely don't want that to happen. You don't want the picture to be so overly touched up that you're, like, not even recognizable, because with digital photography, you can definitely do that now. So you're talking about, the 5 o'clock shadow. Is there something as far as what folks should wear?
Well, if you're talking about a business portrait, as far as ladies' choice of clothing, I tend to stay away from that because that is such a personal decision.
You are such a smart man.
That's a little cowardly, Bill.
Well, I would say that you don't want to have a lot of jewelry on, because that will detract.
Right. What about diamonds? Diamonds good?
Well, everyone looks better in diamonds. As far as men go, I would always advise a dark colored suit. Dark blue is always the best because that will blue is associated with trust, and that's generally the message people want to convey in an image. I would stay away from if I see someone come in a tan colored suit or a plaid suit. I'm like,
you got problems.
You've got problems. Go home.
Do you say, here, borrow my jacket? Is that what you say?
You have a backup.
Yeah, let me redress you.
Oh, that has happened many times.
Oh, gosh. Wow. Well, you know, folks are with the theme of the economy today, it's definitely one area that people don't want to cut corners because you can tell when
Absolutely. A good picture makes a world of difference.
Absolutely. So how can folks reach you, whether they're a corporation or an individual that needs some quality photography?
Well, my telephone number is 770-953-1719. My website is www.billadler.com, B-I-L-L-A-D-L-E-R.com.
Terrific. Check out the website, definitely.
Do you have before and after pictures of like what their old pictures look like and then the ones you took, so compare?
No, don't generally put the before pictures up there.
Thanks so much for being with us today, Bill. We appreciate you sharing your expertise with us, and we hope our listeners that are in need of quality photography will reach out and contact you.
Well, I enjoyed being here. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much. Lee, another great show.
Yeah. Good guest. Good show. Simple formula.
It really is. And I love the uplifting spirit we bring, right?
That's it. We try.
It's got to get better.
It is better.
Yeah. And it's funny, the Jet Sox guy was talking about the frost. Yesterday, I had to scrape my windows.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, granted, I left in the dark, but it
was starting to get cold.
I'm not used to that in the South. That's a northern thing. Had to get the gloves out. All right, Lee. Until next week, I'm Amy Otto with the Atlanta Business Radio Show.